Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Robert Henri was referring to a cadaver he and his brother had just dissected when he confessed in an 1886 diary entry, "You put yourself in his place." Over the next two decades, Henri developed and taught an approach to painting the body that emphasized breathing, feeling, and moving with one's subject in reciprocal exchange. George Bellows, one of his students, embodied Henri's theories in his fleshy, intuitive art, drawing on the experience of his own athletic body to picture the raw physicality of street kids, workers, and boxers. Speaking at the second annual John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art, held on March 23, 2018, at the National Gallery of Art, John Fagg explores the possibilities and limits of Bellows' painting as a way to know and represent the bodies and lives of others. The John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art is made possible by a grant from the Walton Family Foundation.
You put yourself in his place, George Bellows and the limits of bodily knowledge. This is what muscle feels like. This is what it is to clench and stretch and strain. Orthographic strokes poured wet on wet through paint that preserves the trace and scrape of bristles work to render bulge and flex. Intersecting sweeps and curves that build masses and ripples of flesh. Pigment weld in pit and knot of joints, deep shade crevices and white highlights on sweat-slicked skin. This is George Bellows' idiosyncratic visual lexicon of embodiment. This is painting less concerned with anatomical accuracy than with the urgent communication of what it is to inhabit and be cognizant of one's own body and by extension the bodies of others. These striking passages are taken from three early paintings, Nude Miss Bentham of 1906, a studio posed nude study of a young woman, likely a recent immigrant and a shop girl or domestic servant, 42 Kids of 1907, an iconic ashcan school scene of New York street life in which the children of the city's poor dive and lounge and piss on a dilapidated pier, and both members of this club of 1909, the climatic moment in a brutal fight as two boxers surge at one another in a seedy, semi-legal club. These are bodies made strong and lean from sparring in the city's gymnasiums, diving from its docks and running from its cops, scrubbing its floors and stocking its stores. They are by gender, class, and race, and in innumerable other ways different from Bellows' own body. Art histories that position the ashcan school as observers of urban life rightly emphasize their difference and distance from their subjects. Painting New York's workers, street kids, and boxers in realist idiom, imbricated in spectatorial and disciplinary ways of seeing, Bellows, bourgeois, college-educated, recently arrived from Columbus, Ohio, was far removed from the lives and the scenes he depicts. The Barber Institute of Fine Art at the University of Birmingham, where I teach, recently acquired Nude Miss Bentham, and spending time looking at, writing about, and curating a small exhibition around this anti-beautiful painting made me think for the first time, and then carefully, about ashcan school studio nudes, about the importance of the life class to these artists' formation and pedagogy, and to the complex, hard-won approach to the body preached by Robert Henri. This talk sets out what Henri took and discarded from precedents and teachers and what he passed on to his students. It considers Bellows and his art as embodiment of Henri's teaching, and it closes with both members of this club as a challenge to the ashcan school art of the body. In Philadelphia in the fall of 1886, Henri, freshly enrolled at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, and his brother Frank, training at Jefferson Hospital as a surgeon, cut up a corpse. Later that day, Henri wrote in his diary, "The horrors of the dissecting room have little effect on me. It is not as terrible as the outsider would think. Although, once in a while, you put yourself in his place, mentally, and see yourself skinned and literally cut into mincemeat, laughed, smoked, jested, lectured over. But the purpose." At PAFA, Henri at first embraced the anatomy-focused curriculum developed by the recently departed Thomas Aikens and perpetuated by his colleague Thomas Anschutz. "More and more interested in anatomy," runs a typical diary entry, alongside sketches from Rimmer's and Marshall's artistic anatomy textbooks. But that strange moment of empathy, that urge to put himself in the place of a dissected and radically objectified cadaver, hints at the break Henry would make from aspects of Aiken's and Anschutz's programme, from its insistence on clinical rigour and dispassionate observation. In Paris, in 1888, Henry responded with similar enthusiasm to Bergerot's teaching at the Académie Julienne, with its constant emphasis on work from life models, as shown here in Jefferson David Chalfant's painting. During his second spell at Julienne's in 1890, Henry's old feelings of empathy resurfaced and new doubts set in. "One seldom gives much thought to the ordinary model," he confided in his diary, before expressing concern for a thin, tired, sad-eyed life model whose apparent physical and mental deterioration over the course of the term, like the plight of the cadaver, led him to break from dispassionate study. Henry became increasingly disillusioned with his teachers and, following his final criticism with Bergerot, noted, "Sometimes he has almost abused me, for I have come to work in a way quite different from the line procedure which he lays down. In fact, quite different from the rest of the school." On finally passing the Ecole de Beaux Arts exam, Henry was dismayed to find himself drawing from casts. "I don't like the latter work much. Be the antique ever so perfect in form, be the living model ever so there, ever so awkward, there is always a living charm, a something yet greater in the latter than the classic perfections of the antique." Responding to these experiences and inspired by reading Emerson, Henry declared, "The cold facts of careful execution, if that is art, I shall never be an artist." In a letter home, he explained, "For the time being, I lay aside all precept about what it is to paint, where to put paint and leave it. Decided to muck around and search out what I wanted. My study looked it too, dirty, unscienced, but alive." Back in America, Henry developed this credo in works such as this dirty, unscienced, charcoal nude study and his inspirational teaching. In a 1901 lecture that resonates with Walt Whitman's assertion in Democratic Vistas, "I repeat it, don't want to know too exactly all the reasons why," Henry told students at Philadelphia's School of Design for Women, "One's early fancy of man and things must not be forgotten. One's appreciation of them is too much sullied by cold calculating and dissecting." A decade later, in New York, his student Alice Klauber transcribed a life class in which Henry declared, "A nude young girl in the light is a mystery. I wish to know and could understand the reason for my great pleasure and to be able to paint the sensation." Breaking with Aiken's and Anschutz and Bergerot did not for Henry mean simply abandoning the life class and the studio for the street, but rather working differently, pursuing not scientific knowledge and anatomical rigor, but the affect and sensation bodies produce. Recalling his first encounter with Henry, the painter Guy Pendubois describes the charismatic instructor striding into the life class and questioning the manhood of students who could draw or paint this woman in all her glorious nudity as though she were a plaster cast, a thing less alive than a cabbage. Recalling his first encounter with Henry, Bellows declared, "My brains were as innocent as college could make them. My life begins at this point." The New York School of Art life class was an important formative space for Bellows, whose lithograph recollection invokes movement, energy, jostling easels, and spontaneous critique, and for his contemporary Edward Hopper, whose drawing shows a quiet, more contemplative experience. In this 1912 etching, John Sloan recalls a series of anatomy lectures given by Anschutz in 1905 at the school at Henry's invitation. Sloan places himself, Henry, Bellows, and other members of their circle, roughly there, among an audience whose rapt attention suggests not a break with Anschutz's teaching, but a profound engagement with it. Their dirty, unscienced difference is marked by the graffiti-daubed walls which contrast the clinical cleanliness Aikens had instilled at Paffer. As his students painted, Henry paced about, uttering a stream of mnemonic advice. "Take the pose of the model yourself, then you can feel the pull of the muscles. Think, are the energies of the model in your painting? Demand of the model all your greatest ideas. See the dignity of the model. See the man in him. The model is dependent on your idea of her. Your canvas should be a thing created under the influence of her. Again, Henry's empathetic, gender-fluid appreciation of the body is Whitmanian in thought and cadence. The embodiment of many of Henry's ideas, observed another of his students, Helen Appleton Reed, was found in the early work of George Bellows. This is among the first iterations of the oft-repeated claim that Henry's practice fell short of what he preached, that his ideas were made paint by the artists he inspired, and that Bellows was his most adept and faithful student. In the summer of 1906, Bellows ended his formal study with Henry, and though still enthralled to his teacher, set up his own studio. According to biographer Charles Morgan, the first work he painted there was Nude Miss Bentham. In class, Henry said, "Remember that your model is not against space, but in it. That is what is real to us, and what we enjoy is the space, not the walls of a room." And then said, "Furniture and clothes are the escape of the bad artist." And Bellows duly painted Miss Bentham without furniture or clothes, enveloped in dark, sensuous space. "Think of the eyelid and the lip together," Henry told his students. "They're different features, but they concert to express the same emotion. And the ragged, sharp peak lines of Miss Bentham's lip and brow rhyme and echo one another across her troubled face." More than this, though. Picturing Miss Bentham on Henry's terms and in his own painterly repertoire of bodily gestures, Bellows produced a studio nude that goes beyond generic conventions and acknowledges the complex encounter between painter and sitter. Dark pigment demarcates the hollow of Miss Bentham's cheek, the rut between her shoulder blades and the pronounced cleft at the base of her spine. Her torso is all skin and protruding bone. Her left arm and shoulder are worked in paler flesh tones and looser strokes. The lighter, thinner paint suggests a slight, scrawny upper body. By contrast, her buttocks and stomach are fleshier and weightier, giving the figure a weary, downward energy. Bellows pulls reddish pigment through the elbows, buttocks, knees, heels, and toes to register the abrasion and contact of sitting, kneeling and standing. This is a body that works and moves in the world, that knows labor and feels pain. Bellows' facility in brushwork, molding, and his fluid way with muscular comes through in the description of Miss Bentham's surprisingly strong arm. But Reed's embodiment meant something else here too. Bellows' brains may have been as college innocent when he first met Henry, but his body carried important knowledge. Far from a natural athlete, Bellows had trained himself to succeed at baseball and basketball, working his way onto Ohio State teams in both sports, and in baseball up to semi-professional status and a contract offer from the Cincinnati Reds. Sports, then as now, involved numerous team photographs in uniform and in cocksure poses. And that Bellows preserved in scrapbooks, seeing himself as a physical specimen and presence over and over again. The idea that Bellows' tall, athletic body expressed the artistic vigor and energy urged by Henry figures prominently in Reed's and others' accounts of his work. But perhaps more significantly, sports attuned Bellows to his own body, making him particularly responsive to Henry's call for an art of physical sensation. An Ohio acquaintance, Edward M. Burroughs, recalled that off the diamond or the basketball floor, Bellows was ungainly and awkward, puzzled what to do with his long arms and 6'2" of height. In baseball, all this was changed. Sure-footed and swift, he drifted and bounded about the infield with the indescribable grace of an acrobat. It's this complex mix of physical mastery and ungainliness that shaped Bellows' engagement with the bodies of others. Nude Miss Bentham is an awkward, vulnerable painting. Bellows stretched a large canvas for his first independent work, but both he and Miss Bentham seem to shrink and retreat from its dimensions. She does not pose on a block, but stands directly on the ground, and the painting looks down from above her, inviting viewers to imagine Bellows' 6'2" frame looming over a much smaller woman. Her taut, clenched jaw presses into her neck, and the discomfort that goes beyond the physical demands of the pose finds further expression in the arm clasped tight across her breast. Awkwardness was for Henry one of the evidences of living charm that separate life models from castes. For art historian Linda Nochlin, awkwardness and disharmony contribute to the anti-beauty that signals realist painting's antinomic relationship to romanticized or idealized imagery. Its presence here might also pertain to the relationship between artist and model. How sure of himself was Bellows, an artist fresh out of school, as he told or showed her how to pose? Might some of the off-court awkwardness described by Burroughs have transmitted itself from artist to model, or shaped the way in which Bellows saw and imagined the bodies of others? The pose study, Nude Miss Bentham. hung prominently in Bellow's studio, articulating its relationship to more familiar portrait types, such as Queenie Burnett, who we saw earlier today, and Portrait of a Laughing Boy, as well as gritty urban scenes, including the charcoal drawing Election Night Times Square, and at top right, and his first boxing study, A Knockout. Absent from the scene, perhaps because it was exhibited frequently in the years this photograph was taken, is another of Bellow's striking treatments of naked bodies, 42 Kids. In her discussion of this painting, art historian Rebecca Zurier contrasts Bellow's bodies with those in Thomas Aiken's The Swimming Hole, where Aiken's painted with an exhaustive knowledge of anatomy, Zurier argues, the muscular action of Bellow's figures has nothing to do with the scientific study of nature. Their limbs are impossibly elongated, their gestures frog-like, their eyes rendered as dots and their noses as commas. Similarly, Marion Dozimer explains that the visual coding of Bellow's slum kids positions them as figure types of the other half. His treatment of the naked boys in 42 Kids was so extreme, Dozimer writes, that critics referred to them as animalculi and maggots. Both Zurier and Dozimer agree that these othered bodies are derived at least in part from the era's popular visual stereotypes of immigrants and African Americans. But looking closely at the central group of boys on the pier, might we not see at least some of these figures as enactments of Henry's unscienced desire to express the way bodies feel and move? For sure, there are clusters of undifferentiated and distorted body parts, but elsewhere there are plausible figures and postures, shoulder blades pinched together here, a chest puffed out there, sinews strain, limbs stretch, backs twist and bend and buttocks clench. Bellow's brushy strokes, abrupt shadow and highlights and streaks and smears do not transcribe, pronounce precise anatomies, but share a common language with his and other Ashcan School artists' gestures and expressions of how bodies feel. It's not hard to imagine the artist stepping back from his easel and affecting a hands-on hip strut or crouching forward as if to dive, taking the pose of his subjects as Henry urged, that he might feel the pull of the muscles. The representation of bodies profoundly other to the artist's own in 42 Kids is heightened in the series of boxing paintings that begins with, or boxing works that begins with The Knockout of 1907. Art historian Robert Haywood contrasts the sordid spaces and dangerous animal-like combat of these scenes with the middle-class atmosphere and muscular Christianity of the YMCA, where Bellows briefly lived and regularly played basketball. Bellows acknowledged, as Charlie's explained, that he was an outsider at ringside, unfamiliar with the rules and fine details of the sport. The Knockout and the three major paintings that followed it all convey the otherness of the fighters, the ring and the crowd, with grotesque faces looming and popping from the gloom. The art historian David Peters Corbett characterizes the boxing scenes as images of abjection, of that which reminds us of ourselves, but simultaneously of what is outside us. The sprawling, wounded, and near-naked fighter in The Knockout embodies the lurid fascination abject bodies hold. It is this spectacle, Peters Corbett writes, this vision of the disempowered, the vulnerable, and the victimized that many in the audience crane and jostle forward to consume. Bellow's early images of boxing can be seen to participate in that dynamic, presenting the viewer with vicarious access to bodies marked as other by class and by their stripped, spotlit vulnerability and their damaged, disempowered state. The alterity of the boxers' bodies is most palpable in the last of the early boxing paintings, both members of this club. This 1909 painting coincides with and seems inextricably bound to the moment in which the African-American boxer Jack Johnson won and held the heavyweight title, upending the quasi-scientific discourse of white racial superiority and setting in motion the anguished quest for a great white hope. While there's no suggestion that the painting is a direct representation of those events, cultural historian Cassia Bodie argues that both members of this club is the image which perhaps best encapsulates the white response to Johnson. Bellows restages black and white contest, black against white contest, and the anxiety and the white anxiety of black victory at a different weight class and within the confines of a small-scale boxing club. That Bellows shared in the anxiety provoked by Johnson, and that he saw black boxers' bodies as different and other, is marked in his record book, as we saw, which lists the original title as A Nigger and a White Man. That title is hard to say and to think about, but as art historian Martin Berger has recently observed, while often noted, its implications for Bellows and his painting are rarely dwelt on. The otherness and abjection that mark all the boxing scenes are here heightened and recast, imbued with what theorist Deborah Walker King terms the symbolic properties of black pain hidden beneath America's love-hate relationship with the black body. It's surely no coincidence that it is the black boxer's body that brings Bellows' visual language of bodily sensation to its fullest, most extreme expression. Here, anatomy is overwhelmed, a straining cylinder of taut muscle comes apart from the body, gestures of musculature become almost abstract. A still earlier sporting image suggests boxing may not have been quite so far outside Bellows' own experience. Though staid in comparison to the ghoulish boxing crowd, spectators in the 1906 drawing Basketball nonetheless appear grotesque and menacing. Rapt faces emerge from the shadowy mass of watching bodies, limbs and fists protrude from the group. The ball itself is hidden from view, locked in a fierce tussle between two players whose muscles strain and legs contort and whose bodies grind and collapse into one another in a heavily worked passage of dense charcoal shading. Both the point at which one figure's head and face crush into the other's thrusting forearm and the pyramidal composition of the two men's legs and torsos suggest this work as a model for the depiction of fighters' bodies in the knockout and the boxing paintings, including perhaps most directly Staggett Sharkey's. Bellows played basketball throughout his time at Ohio State University and at the YMCA and for various semi-pro teams once relocated to New York. He must have found himself in many clinches of this kind, and his own body must have known such moments of intense physical impact. He knew also what it was to be cheered and jeered and gazed at and consumed by a rowdy crowd, as is apparent in Basketball, and in this drawing, Sweeney, the idol of the kids, had hit a home run. Bill Sweeney, an Ohio batter Bellows likely knew, stands proud and tall in light revealing shorts. Another long-limbed man, who strongly resembles Bellows' frequent depiction of himself, sits completely naked, looking back into the penetrating stares of the boys and men who mass inside and outside the locker room. Hunched, with bare buttocks planted on a bare wooden board, this is an uncomfortable self-representation that catches Bellows somewhere between the on-field grace and everyday ungainliness. Basketball and Sweeney suggests there is an autobiographical trace in the boxing images, some reciprocity between his own experience and that of his subjects. Was that enough? Do those scant shared experiences bridge the empathy gap between painter and subject, spectator and spectacle? Did Henry's insistence on painting as reciprocal encounter, ingrained in Bellows by 5 years of sustained practice and expressed in a complex visual language of embodiment, facilitate a meaningful connection with the black boxer in both members of this club, in spite even of the artist's own consciously articulated fear of or contempt for that man? Might form and technique, those striking ways of feeling out bodily sensations with paint and brush, transcend the moment of the great white hope and allow us to see in this figure some truth Bellows briefly inhabited but could not really know? Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.